VOA 1, the hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Dan Friedel.
And I'm Katie Weaver. This program is aimed at English learners. So we speak slowly, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, we have a higher education story about college applications. After the U.S. Supreme Court recently ruled on how schools can consider the race of applicants when making admissions choices, many colleges and universities are asking for extra information from students in the form of a writing sample. Then, Ana Mateo is here with words and their stories. She discusses multiple ways English speakers talk about plans and ideas. My advice? Use your imagination. After that, Kelly Jean Kelly presents the next part in our series on America's presidents. This week, Benjamin Harrison. But first, here's Brian Lynn.
New rules aim to protect horseshoe crabs, which are used in medical research and also to support an endangered bird species. Blue blood from horseshoe crabs is used by researchers to test for dangerous substances in vaccines, medicines, and medical devices. The animals are also used by fishermen as bait to catch eels and sea snails. In addition, the eggs of horseshoe crabs are an important food for an endangered bird called the red knot. Scientists say horseshoe crabs have been living in ocean environments for more than 400 million years. But they are different from other crabs. They are more closely related to spiders and scorpions. The animals have been decreasing in numbers in areas they live in, called habitats, along the U.S. East Coast. New guidelines for dealing with horseshoe crabs were approved in May by the Atlantic States Marine Fisheries Commission. Industry officials said those changes should keep more crabs alive, but in recent years, environmentalists brought attention to the issue of the horseshoe crabs, including their relationship to the red knot. Red knots are birds that travel about 30,500 kilometers back and forth from South America to Canada. During their long trip, the birds must stop to eat along the way, and horseshoe crabs are an important food. Bethany Kraft is a coastal conservation specialist with the environmental organization, the Audubon Society. Kraft told the Associated Press that red knots need horseshoe crab eggs to give them enough fuel to complete their long flights. The new guidelines urge best practices for the biomedical industry's harvesting and processing of the crabs. I'm Brian Lynn.
August 1st is the start of the new college admissions season in the United States. It is the day students can start to complete the common application for college admission in 2024. The common application is accepted by over 1,000 colleges and universities. The service permits students to apply to many schools by submitting their information only one time. However, some colleges and universities that accept the common application are asking students to send in an extra piece of writing. They are using the extra prompt to give students a chance to discuss their background. The reason for this new writing prompt is the U.S. Supreme Court's recent decision to end affirmative action in college decisions. The court said selective colleges and universities, such as Harvard University or the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, can no longer use race as a way to decide between two qualified students. But the court did say schools can consider an applicant's discussion of how race affected his or her life. That is why some schools are rewriting their prompts.
At Yale University, students who apply with the Common Application must also answer one of three questions. The first question permits students to write about a time they discussed an important issue with someone holding an opposing view. Another question asks students to discuss a meaningful community to which they are connected. But a third question is new compared to past years. It asks students to talk about part of their personal experience that you feel will enrich your college. That question permits a student to state their race and discuss how they would add something special to the group of students at Yale. At Emory University in Atlanta, Georgia, a new prompt asks students to tell about a community that you have been part of, where your participation helped to change or shape the community for the better. Timothy Fields is a top admissions official at Emory. He said the new questions are going to be much more targeted. At Sarah Lawrence College outside of New York City, a new question asks students how the Supreme Court decision on affirmative action might affect their lives. Kevin McKenna is a vice president at the college. He said the new question gives students a chance to discuss the decision that could impact the student bodies of the colleges to which they are applying.
In addition to the new questions, many colleges and universities are thinking about how to connect with Black and Latino students. The school leaders worry that those students may think they are no longer welcome at selective universities after the Supreme Court decision. Amin Abdul Malik Gonzalez is the top admissions official at Wesleyan University in Connecticut. He and his team are planning extra time at high schools and more meetings at college information events to tell minority students they are still welcome. He also will offer more training to his admissions officers so they can work to build a diverse group of students without going against the Supreme Court's decision. Visits such as those by the Wesleyan team are important, said Angel Perez. He is head of the National Association for College Admission Counseling. Perez said some college counselors for high school students are uncertain how their students should address their race in applications. The general feeling with school counselors right now is mostly anxiety, he said.
But those who work with students, like private admissions counselor Shireem Herndon Brown, say students should not overstate how race affects their lives. Herndon Brown wrote a book with Fields, the admissions leader at Emory. He said students need to write authentically about how they think and have developed as a result of their background. He gave an example of a Black student from New York who recently visited relatives in the southern part of the U.S. Herndon Brown encouraged the student to write about that experience, although it was not in the student's original plan. "That," he said, "is a better idea than declaring their race or overstating their disadvantage." There is no way to trick an admissions officer or a school into believing you're something that you're not, he says. I'm Jill Robbins.
And I'm Dan Friedel.
VOA Learning English has launched a new program for children. It is called Let's Learn English with Anna. The new course aims to teach children American English through asking and answering questions and experiencing fun situations. For more information, visit our website, learningenglish.voanews.com. And now, words and their stories from VOA Learning English. Great ideas can be the lifeblood of any project. That means they can bring a project to life, or even back from the dead. From redesigning a home to creating an educational product, bold, creative ideas are valuable. But often, even a great idea needs a little work. It may need tweaking, meaning you need to make small changes. So before sharing an idea with a large group, we may want to share it with a smaller group. We can test it out first, before putting the idea into action. But first, let's talk about getting that big idea. You may have heard of brainstorming. This is an idea-creating activity. When we brainstorm, we say ideas as quickly as we think of them. In informal situations, we can call this throwing spaghetti at the wall. Why, you may ask? Well, cooked spaghetti is sticky. If spaghetti is cooked enough, it will stick when you throw it against the wall. If it is not cooked enough, it might not stick. Good ideas stick too. In brainstorming, we often say we throw ideas around, and the good ones stay or stick. But as we said earlier, even if an idea sticks, we may want to test it out before sharing it with a large group of people. That is when we can run it up the flagpole. Running an idea, plan, or proposal up the flagpole is a way to test interest or get feedback. The full phrase is run it up the flagpole and see if anyone salutes. Military members salute when our flag is present and when they hear the first note of the national anthem. Let's listen to an example. If you are the leader of a project, you could say to your team, "I like that plan, but it is risky. Let's run it up the flagpole before pitching it to the boss." In other words, you want to get more opinions before making the plan official. Here is another example. When writing these stories, I often run my ideas up a flagpole. I respect the opinions of my coworkers and often take their suggestions on board, meaning I take them into consideration. So I like bouncing ideas off them. And that is a more common way to express this idea. Bouncing something off someone is a way to know their thoughts. You are asking their opinion and are looking to see their reaction. Bouncing ideas around is a good way to gauge interest, to find out what people think. So the next time you have an idea and you are unsure about it, run it up the flagpole. Bounce it off some friends. With the right people, you will soon know if it is good, bad, or needs work. And that's all the time we have for this Words and Their Stories. Until next time, I'm Ana Mateo.
I'm Dan Friedel, and you're listening to the Learning English Broadcast. We just heard Ana Mateo discuss English phrases that have to do with testing out an idea or a plan. Ana joins us now. Ana, you're lucky. I just got some new shoes. They are really sticky. I think I should be able to use them to run up the flagpole I have outside.
Hold on there, Dan. You do not have to put shoes on to run something up a flagpole. In this case, we are talking about a flag or an idea. It's definitely not a good idea to try to run up a flagpole.
Ah, I get it. When we talk about running something up a flagpole, we are thinking about a real flag that is attached to a rope and then run up to the top. In this case, instead of a flag, we're talking about an idea. So if someone salutes the idea, that means they offer their approval, just in the same way someone might salute a national flag. It shows they're supporting whatever the flag represents.
Yes, Dan, that's right. You've got it.
Okay, good. That was a tough one, Ana. Let's talk about bouncing ideas off someone. I really like throwing things, so I've got my ideas here written down and attached to some bouncy balls. Now I have to look for someone to bounce them off.
Oh, Dan. That's not how it works. I like that you have so many ideas, but it is not necessary to throw anything. Maybe just talk about these great ideas with your wife and see what she thinks. That is how you bounce an idea off someone.
Thanks, Ana. It also probably makes for a safer home and workplace. Have you bounced an idea off someone recently? What happened?
Yes, I am preparing a presentation about future jobs for some students in Ukraine. I want it to be fun, so I bounced some game ideas off a coworker to get his input. And he gave me some great ideas.
Hey, that's great. I'm sure the students will be happy that you discussed the ideas beforehand. Thanks, Ana. This conversation was fun. I wish we could keep bouncing ideas off each other or running up flagpoles all day. But we have to move on.
You're welcome, Dan. Anytime.
VOA Learning English presents America's Presidents. Today we are talking about Benjamin Harrison. His family name may sound familiar. That is because he was the grandson of President William Henry Harrison. That situation is unique in U.S. history so far. Harrison played an unusually active role as president at a time when most chief executives saw themselves as simply administrators. As a result, American writer and intellectual Henry Adams said, "Harrison was the best president since Lincoln." But most Americans remember little about him, except his connection to the previous President Harrison, who himself died after only a month in office.
Benjamin Harrison grew up on a farm in the Midwestern state of Ohio as one of eight children. His grandfather was not the only famous political Harrison. His great-grandfather signed the Declaration of Independence, and his father had been a congressman. Young Benjamin Harrison respected these men and believed he had a role to play in history, too. He received a good education, and even outside of school, he read many books. His hard work and intelligence carried him to Miami University in Ohio, and then to a career as a lawyer. Along the way, he married a woman he had known since he was a teenager, Carolyn Lavinia Scott. The couple settled in another Midwestern city, Indianapolis, Indiana, and had a son and daughter. Over time, Harrison steadily built a career as a public official. But his political path was interrupted by the American Civil War. Harrison rose to the rank of general in the Union Army. He fought under General William T. Sherman and was one of the first soldiers to enter Atlanta, Georgia, after the city surrendered. Reports say that Harrison was an excellent soldier, but he did not enjoy fighting or find war romantic. After the war, he returned home to Indiana and continued his legal and political career. In 1881, he was elected to the U.S. Senate. But 6 years later, he lost his seat when Democrats came to power in his state. Harrison's loss of his Senate seat soon turned to a victory. The Republican Party nominated him as their candidate to run against Grover Cleveland in the 1888 presidential election. Cleveland's economic policies had become unpopular, and Republicans worked hard to support their candidate. They succeeded. Although Cleveland won the popular vote, Harrison won the Electoral College. In 1889, he followed his grandfather's footsteps all the way to the White House. Harrison's election was a major victory for his Republican Party. In addition to winning the White House, Republicans gained seats in the House of Representatives, held a majority in the Senate, and appointed several Republican justices to the Supreme Court. Harrison and other Republican lawmakers used their power to take action on issues at home and internationally. One act was to preserve forests. Harrison identified 17 protected natural areas and helped create Yosemite National Park in California. His government also established Ellis Island in New York to make immigration to the U.S. a more orderly process. Internationally, Harrison's administration sought to build ties with Latin American countries. His government established what would, in time, become the Organization of American States. His administration also increased the United States' global trade, as well as the country's navy. But, for the most part, the most pressing issues of the day were economic. The federal government at that time had an unusually large surplus. Some argued that the surplus was hurting business. In answer, Harrison's government placed a high protective tariff on imported goods. The legislation was known as the McKinley Tariff of 1890. Officials also aimed to limit the power of large corporations to control important markets in the U.S. Finally, they agreed to require the government to buy silver to use as currency. These actions pleased some of his supporters, but they may have contributed to the severe economic depression that followed Harrison's term. And in general, voters disapproved of the amount of money Republican lawmakers were spending. Although the country was at peace, the 51st Congress appropriated $1 billion. At the midterm elections, many lawmakers paid for all the spending with their seats. 2 years later, voters turned Harrison out of the White House, too. They returned Grover Cleveland to the presidency. Harrison did not express much disappointment. He had worked hard to become president like his grandfather, but he found he did not like being the chief executive. He said, when he left the White House, it was like being released from prison. Among U.S. presidents, Harrison does not have one of the most dramatic biographies. The facts of his life show an intelligent, disciplined man who tried to live by his beliefs. But he was not considered passionate about many things, except perhaps his enjoyment of nature. And he did not have an easy way with people. Even his staff called him the human iceberg, because he could be aloof and act coldly toward people. Yet Harrison's family brought some warmth to his administration. His wife, Carolyn, was known to be a lively, social person. She was the first to install a Christmas tree in the White House. Some of Harrison's grandchildren also lived in the White House. Harrison permitted them to play on the grounds with their pet animals. During Harrison's term, the family kept a goat, which the children called Old Whiskers. Harrison's time in the White House saw sorrow, too. Toward the end of her husband's term, the First Lady became seriously ill with tuberculosis. For months, Benjamin Harrison divided his attention between his wife and his job, and yet in the end lost both. After his term as president ended, Harrison returned to his home in Indianapolis. He did some work as a teacher and lawyer and kept a good public image in his community. He also remarried. His second wife was a widow herself, as well as his first wife's niece. He and Mary Scott Lord Dimmick Harrison had a daughter together. The child was only 4 when Harrison died from pneumonia at age 67. I'm Kelly Jean Kelly.
And that's the Learning English broadcast for today. Thank you, Kelly, for that report. And thanks to our VOA colleagues for their work on today's program.
Most importantly, thank you for listening. For more, visit our website at learningenglish.voanews.com. I'm Katie Weaver.
And I'm Dan Friedel.